Hello and welcome to another edition of Living with Dying, the podcast where we try to demystify death a bit and ask people to kind of prepare for it and talk about it a bit. And I'm really thrilled today to be joined by Nina Nanna, who you'll all know is the arts editor of ITV News, who has such a busy life. I'm just staggered. I follow her on social media and she's always doing something. She's at the Oscars or the BAFTAs, or she's talking to actors and she's going to gigs. And yet her husband died 3 years ago. And I'm really, really intrigued to talk to her about how she managed to kind of get the energy back up to go back to work. But Nina, can we start by talking about your husband and what he was like and what happened to him?
Yeah, he was, he's just the best man, probably one of the best people I've ever met in my life, really. And I met him, which is a really great story. I met him at in Machu Picchu. I was on a trek as an ambassador for a charity. And they kept saying, you've got to do one of our events. So I said, right, I'll do Machu Picchu. That doesn't look too difficult. And he had been in England and was on his way back home to New Zealand. And he wanted to do this trek on his way home. So we actually met at Machu Picchu. I kind of was intrigued by him straight away. You know, I thought, I really, really like this man. And we just hit it off straight away. And he carried on going home to New Zealand, but then he came back. And in later years, he would say, oh, you ruined my life, you know, that sort of thing. But he didn't mean it, of course. So, yeah, and that was it. Pretty instant thing. He was really lovely, in a world completely different to mine. He was a garden designer. He knew every plant. He made beautiful gardens for people. We were living in London at that time. And my world was completely different. You know, my world is about, you know, it's news and it's fast moving and it's stressful and it's a little bit silly. And I would just come home and say, you'll never guess what happened at work today. You know, somebody did this and they cut my piece on news at 10 by 30 seconds. And he would look at me as if to say, and, you know, it was just, the contrast was amazing. And our daughter is the best of the both of us. And he was just the most wonderful, wonderful man. But he was born with a fault in his kidney, which today would be sorted out almost in the womb, very straightforward. But it wasn't spotted until he was a teenager in New Zealand and he collapsed and nearly died. And then they said, oh, the valve in makeup of the kidney, oh, it's not working. So all these toxins were being pumped back into his body. So he had a kidney transplant in New Zealand. And he spent 3.5 years strapped to a dialysis machine, very primitive in those days. He couldn't go to college. He couldn't work. He was a surfer. He couldn't do anything. And he spent, 3.5 years strapped up to that machine, missing out on life, basically, being nursed by his mother, until eventually one day the phone went and they said, we've got you a kidney. And, you know, that kind of being close to death for a long time, I think that sort of informed Steve's entire life. You know, he really, when he looked and would say, look at the sky, and most people go, yeah, it's nice, isn't it? But he really did mean look at the sky. Or he would say, gosh, that rose bush is doing really well. And you give it a cursory glance. Oh, yeah, it's doing really well. But that wasn't Steve. He really did look at it, said, look at it. You know, have you noticed how that shoot has done this or that flower has done that? I mean, he was very much in the moment, because being that close to death had really taught him about valuing beautiful, real things. And my silly old world, you know, which, I mean, in some levels you might call it quite superficial, was such a contrast to him. But we kind of grounded each other. I dragged him a bit into reality and he kept my feet on the ground. So it was just that, it was a perfect marriage. And unfortunately, his kidney started failing. It lived far longer than it should have done. And we moved to Norfolk because just to chill, have a good life, have the beach, have blue skies, all the things he loved as a Kiwi. And we just took a massive punt, moved to Norwich. I mean, I became a commuter, which I never wanted to do, but I wanted Steve to be well more than that. And we moved to Norwich and it was beautiful and kidney lived a lot longer. And then eventually had another kidney transplant, which was very traumatic. Unfortunately, one of the side effects of the medication that one has to take to keep the body from rejecting this organ they've developed a lot over the years, but Steve had been taking them for 40 years, you know. One of the side effects was skin cancer. So every year he would go and get the growths on the back of his, on his back mainly cut off, but they grew bigger and bigger, and they were on his shoulder, and I was having to take him in for day surgery to have lumps removed. I mean, horrible. And then Mimi and I, our daughter, we would be changing the bandages, and it was the most horrible thing. He never complained about anything whatsoever. I mean, he had gone back onto dialysis before he got the second transplant. Now, most people would have found that. I mean, it's horrible. It's truly horrible. We'd have all this equipment shipped to our house, and we had hooks all over the house where he'd hang his dialysis machine, you know, whilst we were eating, whilst we were watching television. We managed to go camping. He worked out a way of doing it. He never complained once. And I know from the bottom of my heart that I would have complained and made a really big deal out of it. But he just didn't. He got on with it because being alive was great. He's had a daughter, you know, he never thought he would have a family. And then, as I say, he had the second transplant, and then it deteriorated pretty quickly. The skin cancer went to his ear, and then the surgeons removed his ear. So he had a big gap in his ear, and that was very upsetting to him. But he would show me, go, look, these days you can get prosthetic ears, and we'd look at the shape of the ear. You know, that's what he was saying. I can get one of those. But, you know, very, very, very quickly, the skin cancer travelled, and it travelled to his brain, which we weren't really aware of. And, you know, it all happened very, very quickly and very terribly within the last 2 weeks when he was in screeching agony at home. And it was really very nasty and very cruel for such a lovely, kind person that was the end for him. And then he went into hospital, and I expected him to come back. He was going in for radiotherapy, and then we just got a phone call saying, oh, he's a bit distressed, come in. So Mimi and I went in on the Friday, slept on the floor, and he left us on the Monday. And I didn't know what was going on. It was only on the Sunday when the nurse took me to one side and said, you know, I'm really sorry, I think he's dying. And I was saying, no, he's not. He's not dying. He's just, you know, he wants to get out of this room, you know, because he kept getting out of the bed and everything. And it was really, really utterly traumatizing, that whole thing. And I was diagnosed with PTSD afterwards by the hospital. It was very horrible. It was very, very horrible. And then Mimi and I were with him, you know, on the bed with him when he died, basically. And my family had been up, and we drove home. And I think I went into a cloud, of my head went into a cloud, and I opened the door, and my house was full of my family members crying. And I wish I could remember all the details of everything, but a lot of things I think I've blocked out. It was so deeply traumatic for us, and it got more so as it became more real, and that he wasn't in the house and wasn't coming downstairs. And we had a greyhound dog, and we loved to rescue greyhounds. And it was Steve's dog, really. And Tommy used to sleep at the foot of our bed, and I would get out of bed before Steve, and he just wouldn't move for about 3 months. He just stayed up waiting for Steve to get out of bed by Steve's side of the bed. And I'd get up and call him down, and he was just where's my favorite person on earth? Where's Stephen? You know, and it was really, really, really sad and traumatic, you know. And I still sort of can't really believe that somebody as good as that is not in the world anymore. I really can't, you know. I miss him all the time. All the time. I'm just a very good actress.
Well, you have to be, don't you? I'm afraid that's something we learn. The world expects us to get up and get on with things.
Yeah, yeah.
But it sounds like a horrendous story, because you weren't prepared. You were prepared in a way that you would lose him, but that's what the experience you had in hospital sounds ghastly. And nobody had the courage really to come and face up to you and tell you what was going on.
They told us the day before, and I kept trying to read the nurse's face. I mean, they did their best, and they were all really lovely. And and his consultant was really lovely, but I think they were just observing what was going on with us. And then afterwards, the hospital contacted me and said, we can see the signs of trauma with you, which they were right about. And, you know, and they recommended a psychotherapist that I should go and see. And I only saw her yesterday. I'm still seeing her, actually. And yeah, it was, I think he'd never talked about death, you see, ever. And even when he'd be sitting here and be looking really quite ill. And I don't know how I managed to work, because he didn't really want to trouble his sister, and he didn't really want me to trouble my mum, who was really close to my mum. So I had to carry it. I had to respect his wishes. And we had to protect our child. So I carried quite a lot in, you know, without telling anybody really, apart from my sister and, you know, my best friends. But yeah, I felt like, on one occasion I tried to say to him, "Stephen, what do you think is happening here?" And he shut me down straight away, because he didn't want to go there. And I'm the kind of person that needs to go there, because I need to know what's what. That's the way my brain works. I need to know what's coming up, what's the reality, what I need to do. But that's not how Steve operated. And it was his illness, and I had to respect that. We never once said, you know, what happens if you die. We never once went there. And I think about that a lot, that, you know, people say, "Oh, how did you prepare for it and stuff?" But we couldn't prepare for it, because that's not what he wanted to do. So right or wrong, I played along with it, if you like. But it was incredibly difficult, incredibly difficult. And of course, I work in this forward facing, you know, industry, where I couldn't really tell my office much of what was going on, because I couldn't open that box. And work almost was like a bit of a safe space for me. And then I'd go and, you know, my day was sitting down in front of the most famous people you've ever seen on the screen or whatever. And then I'd come home and be changing bandages and looking after my little girl and being a bit traumatized, really. And I lived this for quite a while, you know, until I could see he was really sick, and then I was just at home. But even then, I didn't necessarily share much with the office. I mean, at that stage, I didn't really feel like my office would. I just was made to feel like I had to keep working, and that I'd be letting a lot of people down if I wasn't in the office doing my job. I ran a whole bureau by myself. I had enormous pressure on me, and my requests for help were not, you know, they were not listened to, but to everyone else, I was doing a great job on my own. So I don't think I'll probably ever recover from what I had to carry for so long on my own professionally. I'm not sure that I can really forgive my employers to a certain extent for that.
You were carrying two different loads, weren't you? You were carrying the kind of secret of what was going on with Steve, and you were carrying the pressure at work as well. So, God, that must have been hard.
Yeah, it was really, really hard. Really hard. And I mean, you know, when Stephen died, I took a year out. And my work then could not have been more supportive to me. They left me be. There was new management in. They left me be. You know, the editor came up a couple of times to see me. The outpouring of love I had. I mean, I've got some very, very close friends in that newsroom, and, you know, they would come and visit me, but I was put under absolutely no pressure whatsoever to return. So for all that had happened in the many years leading up to it, they came good. They came good. Probably because there were new people in charge, and I hope they realized, I mean, you know, how much they owed me. I hope they know that. And I think the way they held me up and supported me in that year, hopefully, is evidence to me that whatever might have happened before, my God, we're here for you now. We're here for you now. We might not have been then, but we are now.
I love the fact that you took a year off, because I don't know that many people would have had the common sense really to do that, but that sounds good.
Well, I was in a terrible mess, to be honest. And plus, I had a little girl, and she was about to go through her A-level. She took 4 months off, my daughter, and she I had people coming constantly coming to me, and I had an outlet for crying and whatever, but she boxed it all in. And I rarely remember seeing her cry during the first 6 months. So I was aware that she was withholding it all. And I persuaded her to go and see a therapist as well. I got a therapist for her, and that unlocked things for her. But she was off for 4 months and then went back, and I don't know how she did it, went back to her studies. I mean, she would later say that, you know, she said, "Mum, when we came back from the hospital and you walked into the house first and your mum was there and your sister, and they came and they hugged you and everybody cried around you and I was standing behind you." Mm. She said, I think they took my grief away, was the phrase she used. Mm. And it's very, very interesting, isn't it? You know, very young person that she was very definitely traumatized by feeling, okay, what do I do with my feelings? And she struggled a bit with her friends. Her friends were really, really good, but she really did struggle. But, you know, we're both not 100% yet, but we have each other. She was amazingly close to her father because I worked in London half the week. So she spent so much time with him. So her loss is really great, but my God, she buckled down. She's gone to Cambridge University. So she just threw herself into her studies. She took a year out after her A-levels and knew what she wanted to do. So I couldn't be more proud of her, honestly. But are we both fixed? No, we're not. We're about to go to New Zealand, Ellis, in September. We're taking Stephen's ashes back home. So it's, we were going to go last Christmas, but we both couldn't face it. But we're going to go and do it. Very emotional, but it's what he would have wanted. We're dreading it, but I know it's what Steve would have wanted. All of his friends are flying in from everywhere. We have met a lot of his friends because they used to come here. So we have seen quite a few of them, but they're all flying in from everywhere to see us. And then we're all going to do the ashes together, all the people that he really loved. So it's going to be very, very difficult, but it's okay. That's okay because it's supposed to be difficult. So, and I've just been trying to learn to, when I feel really sad, and this is what therapy is helping me do, is that when I feel really low and sad, which happens a fair bit, I let it in. I'm with it rather than batting it away and going away and doing something else. I'm not great at it yet, I'll be honest, but I try and sit there and let the dagger do its business in my heart and know that I'll come out the other end of it, sort of thing. Because you know how sometimes something happens, it's like a thump on your chest because you suddenly go, it's something that would have been so relevant to your lost husband, and the knowledge suddenly hits you that, you know, whenever I take Mimi, she's done her first year at university, when I take her to university, you know, I just really wanted to cry through the whole thing, but I couldn't. She was so excited. But you know, just, you know, the fact that he doesn't know, he's going to miss the out, he doesn't know that his little girl's an amazing young woman, it's just not fair, is it? You know, I struggle with that a lot, I really do.
And things like that come up and hit you all the time. And I feel it here when you talk about it, because I went to a funeral the other day and immediately it triggers the funeral that I remember and the loss that I have and the fact that they were friends. You know, it keeps coming back. It doesn't really die down, does it?
I mean, just last week, it was Ozzy Osbourne's funeral. Obviously, being the arts editor, that's in my brief. And I knew him a bit. And I just had to say, I can't go and do it. I can't do that. I can't see a coffin doing a procession. I just thought, I'm going to have to protect myself from that because that's Steve's coffin coming down our drive and stopping in front of the house so that I could take the dog out to say goodbye. And so, I mean, I thought, no, that one, that's too triggering. So I just said, that's going to trigger me. I can't do it. You know, no questions asked, you know, to the credit of my work, they let me lead the way and they respect what it is I'm feeling, you know. So it's, and my mum's really poorly at the moment, so it's that, you know, all at once. But I feel like my mum, this is what's supposed to happen. This is the natural order of things. And that wasn't the natural order of things. So that's what makes it so difficult.
So this year that you took off, can you tell me a bit about how that felt? And did you notice any progress during the year? Was there a point when you thought, I'm ready to go back now? Or did you take some persuading?
I don't think I took, I think I knew at the end of the year. I mean, it was, in my industry, you can be forgotten in 2 months, let alone a year. So when I look on, back on it now, I think, but that's how broken I was. There are a lot of people snapping at your heels. Do you know what I mean? In my sort of competitive industry. And you know, you'll never really make up that year. And I mean, I'm still struggling to a certain extent now. I went back to the office, had changed all the technology and everything. And I never got the training to go back. I'm still a bit stuck about how you do stuff. But the first thing I did when I went back was come back and do the Oscars in the March. So it was just less than a year, just a one-off thing, because that's the big thing. I thought that's the big test. And it's not in the office, which I could cope with not being in the office. I had gone back to the office 8 months later just to go in and say hello to everybody, but I was a real mess before I even crossed the threshold. I was doubled up and I found it was agonizing. I cried around the office. I tried to say hello to people, but I just cried my way around the office. It was just a bit too much. So I went off into LA to do the Oscars, and I had a producer working with me who's a dad and a really, you know, he doesn't work there anymore. And he and the cameraman men between them, they absolutely, totally nursed me and looked after me. They couldn't have been more, and I'll always be grateful. I mean, the producer Alex has left now, but the cameraman Mark, he'll always have a special part in place in my heart, because he looked after me, not in a professional way. He looked after me as person to person. You know, he was gentle and kind to me and asked after me and was not afraid to ask me the questions. Because, you know, I don't know about you, Dennis, but what I found is that people don't, they struggle to have the language of what to say to you. And I realized that, what is going on with this grief thing? Sorry, why aren't we all talking about it a bit more? Some people were scared. People were scared to talk to me about it. Well, what I thought was really, I mean, I live in a cul-de-sac. And when Stephen died, next door but one, there was a lady from a Lebanese lady, Middle Eastern lady, who I didn't know that well. But the morning after Stephen died, she basically came to a house. She walked through my front door. I was sitting at my table eating, and she came straight up to me and picked me up and flung her arms around me. She didn't say a word to me, flung her arms around me, put some food on the table, and then she walked out. And that's kind of such an Indian a way of, because in India, when someone's grieving, everyone comes to your house and they scream and bawl their eyes out. And it's like when my dad died, it's like almost like a version of hell. However, it's like an exorcism. You all come in and you absolutely express your heartbreak. There's no tiptoeing. There's just go straight in. I'm going to cry. I'm heartbroken. Here you have it. And it cleanses. It somehow cleanses the air. But it was interesting, the debates. I mean, a lot of people didn't quite know what to say to me, or maybe avoided me for a bit. And I found that really, really weird. It's like, my husband has died, you know, I'm a widow, let's talk about it. But people are too scared to talk about it.
They're too scared to talk about it. They're too scared to mention people's names because they think it'll upset you. But the thing you want most in the world is to talk about the person you've lost.
Absolutely, totally. I mean, I'd say that to my therapist. I'd go and say, nobody's mentioning his name. Mm. And I'd be crying, saying, I need to hear people giving me anecdotes, you know, and then... You know, I on his birthday this year, I said, I want you all to write a Stephen story. Tell me, give me a Stephen anecdote. Please talk about him. I want to hear his name every single day. I want to see people say Steve, you know. And I've got my close circle of friends are amazing. I mean, and have been really, really supportive. Some have fallen by the wayside. That could, you know, in my extreme moments of grief and irrationality and demanding nature, and I was a bit kind of all over the place at times, and you have to be a very, very, very good friend to take that, and most weren't. some weren't, but that's finished and that's fine. But, you know, I when I walk into the office now, people come up to me and they do say, you know, how are you? And I just then start talking about Steve, because I feel like they're allowing me to do it, you know, because I let it be known. I want to talk about him in a very normal way. So, oh God, do you remember when Steve did that? Oh God, Mimi, do you remember what Daddy used to do? And we do that all the time. We do it all the time. I said, we need to be able to talk about Dad. And we do impersonations of him and everything. And it's so refreshing to do. It really is. And, you know, I want to talk about him all the time. And sometimes I find myself talking about him, even when it's not invited.
But the best thing is to have another widow, I find, who knew my husband and I knew theirs. And then we can talk about each other's and talk about anecdotes. And that's great. They're the ones who understand.
You're absolutely right. But I mean, there's a group of us in the newsroom. There's about four of us. And there are the three widows there in the newsroom. And they immediately reached out for me and we formed a little unit and we go away together. And we just talk, and it's so beautiful. And they were so supportive to me. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And through anniversaries and birthdays, when you might find other people might go, oh, it's so tiresome, she's on about Steve again. You know, I just go, I'm thinking about you today, and Nat, I'm thinking about Jeff or whatever. And it's completely okay to do that. And so we go away and all we do is talk about our partners, and it's really beautiful. And that I've got formed a really close fellowship with these people. But you're right, it's finding people who are in the similar situation. You know, when I went back to work, shortly after I went back to work, I interviewed Andrew Lloyd Webber, and he had tragically just lost his son, months before. And I was, when I was talking to him, and I just said to him, Andrew, how are you? And I think he could sort of see that it was more than how are you. I said, you know, your boy. And then I just told him about Steve. And we had a moment, you know, they had to stop the cameras because we were basically talking about how bloody difficult it is to talk about loss and bereavement and how you need to have support and how it's good to talk about these things. And it was just a really, really lovely moment. I really felt for him and he really felt for me. And that's a really nice thing, isn't it?
It is a nice thing, but it's so tragic that it has to be this way around, isn't it? I mean, I found some of the most delightful people I've met have been in the last 2 years, talking to a mother, for instance, who lost her toddler who didn't wake up one morning, and talking to another woman who had to deliver a 9-month dead baby. And they've been so generous with their time and they've wanted to talk. And it's so awful that the world just doesn't allow us the space to do it in normal everyday life.
I mean, I don't know about you, Dilys, but sometimes I think when I start talking about my situation, Steve, I do even wonder, even with friends, I do wonder whether they're thinking enough already. I don't know. It's not awful. And I'm in my head thinking, oh God, you know, shut up.
It's 3 years for both of us. And I was with a widow yesterday or the day before who's only just been bereaved. And she said to me, does it get better? And she's asked me that before. And I say to her, I have to be honest, the grief changes. It becomes different, but you don't like it. You don't like the situation you're in. You don't particularly like the life you've got.
No. Do I like my daughter's gone to university? Do I like sitting watching telly on my own? Do I still wish I could hear Steve coming downstairs in the morning? Every day, 7 days a week, 24/7. Yes, I do. I would give anything to have him sitting watching television, to go for a walk with him. You know, his dog died in October last year, very suddenly. And we grieved all over again. We grieved the dog, but we grieved him all over again. So it never ends. You know, it's been 3 years. Am I better? No, I am not better. Am I better? I'm not a better person. I'm not a better anything. I'm diminished by his loss significantly, but I've learned to manage it. But the pain is stabbing at times, and I still can't. And I'm angered at the unfairness of it all, and I'm angered that I get to carry on and do all this stuff and he can't. And I'm angry that my little girl hasn't got her daddy, most of all. But I've learned how to, you know. Will I appear on television and smile and ask all the right questions of all these people? Yes, I will, because that's the other bit of me that's another bit of me that I can harness professionally, you know, and then I'm me when I come home.
And that's the bit we've hardly talked about, and we're coming to the end now, but that's what I really wanted to ask you, how you managed to gear yourself up again and do the kind of work that you do, because it's so public facing. I mean, it's the epitome of public facing, isn't it? But you do it.
I mean, you know, I go to work and I put on my makeup for the screen or whatever, and it's like putting your mask on, isn't it? And I really, really love my job, and I get to meet really interesting people. And maybe I'm a little bit more discerning in who I pick to interview, that people, maybe I find different kinds of people interesting than I did before to interview. I've got, my office is like a family to me. And when I come in, I don't go into the office that often, but when I come in, I feel a lot of love from people who are just like, hi, Nina, you know, I haven't seen you for ages. And I really enjoy the person I get to be when I go into the office, because it's a different person. And I like being that person, because she makes me feel strong, and she makes me feel like people want to be with me, and that I'm interesting to people, you know, and I get a lot of energy and strength off that. I mean, the fall, you know, it's a steep fall when you get off the train, when I get off the train at Norwich and I'm walking to my taxi to come home, boy, is that a cliff that I fall off. But, you know, that's getting a little bit better. What I have been telling myself to do is I say yes to stuff. I don't know about you, Dillis, but I used to say no to stuff all the time. For the last 2 years, I'm like, no, I can't do that. No, I'm not doing it. And I then, at the start of this year, I said, let's start saying yes to absolutely everything you physically can do, which is exhausting. But that's what I've started doing. I've started saying yes to stuff. And it's kept me busy. It's kept my brain occupied. Is it a little bit of a running away thing? Yes, but I do quite enjoy it at the same time. But, you know, I really do need my work. I think I love my work, and I don't think I've ever needed my work. But since I lost Stephen and went back, I need my work, because it helps me to be a person that I really like, rather than the person when I'm at home and I'm questioning myself and going, do something, you know, and feeling like I'm lacking because I haven't got Stephen. And when I go to London, that bit of my life was always the same. I went to London on my own. I worked in the office on my own. I stayed over in London. You know, all that part of my life is normal. It's only when I come back home that it hits you. But yeah, how do I do it? Oh, I don't know. But I joke and say, oh, I'm a great actress, but I am, you know. And how ironic that I started my life out as a school kid wanting to become an actress and my parents wouldn't let me. But God, I could win a blooming Oscar now, I'm telling you so.
Yours is a special kind of acting. I think most of us who've been bereaved have to act, that's sure. We all put a mask on, don't we? But yours is a special kind, and I'm full of admiration for it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Well, thank you for talking to me. It's been really lovely to hear your experience and to share stuff, because it's obviously very similar but different.
Yeah. Just we need just to take care of ourselves and stuff. So, but I, you know, you see, I talk a lot. I can't tell you how happy I am when people ask me and give and open the door and say, can you talk about Steve? You know, it's one of the nicest things that you can get these days, when people genuinely say, how are you? And they don't want to say, I'm fine. They genuinely want, because I know what's gone on, let's talk about that. That is still a joy to me and a surprise sometimes. So thank you so much for that, Dillis.
Well, that's kind of it. It doesn't happen enough. And my whole campaign is to get people talking about it more. I don't know whether it's working, but it's important. It's so important, isn't it? And it's important to sort of reach out to other people who have been in our situation.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me again, Nina.
Thank you very much, Dillis. Have a good day.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.